This is New York firefighter Raphael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.
Of suicide prevention, mental health promotion, and resilience, where we live, learn, and work. I'm your host, Dr. Sally Fletcher-Thomas, and I'm on a life mission to empower communities with solutions that help people overcome isolation and despair and rekindle a passion for living. Each episode, we're joined by international experts who inspire hope and offer real guidance. Welcome to the show. I am so grateful you are here. We have a world-renowned expert, as usual, on this podcast today, Dr. John Draper. I'm so pleased to have my dear friend and colleague weigh in on a very important topic today, which is about technology and suicide prevention. This month, our theme is really around strategy, and so we're going to be talking today about how technology is involved in the strategy of suicide prevention. And I got really curious about this actually through John, as he was showing me at least a year ago some of the different apps that were coming out that were helpful. There's so many out there, it's really hard to discern which are useful, which are not, which have science behind them, which don't. And I just try to pull together some of those things. So I'll put on the page notes on my blog that I wrote last year on 15 top apps for resilience, mental health, and suicide prevention. I know when I speak, especially to audiences that have parents of teens, people are very concerned about the impact that technology has on their youth mental health. They're worried about the overuse of technology and how these things affect the brain's development. They're worried about exposure to toxic things through technology, like bullying and predators and the sexual content that's out there. And they're worried that, you know, technology in some way is becoming a barrier to other healthy things that youth need, skill building around communication or engagement in sports or outdoors. And, you know, there's reasons for these concerns. We know that children 8 to 18 are spending on average 7 hours online, and adults are not far behind. But today we're really going to talk about the positive things about technology and the fact that we have really great resources, especially around treatment, you know, how we can make treatment for mental health issues and suicide crises that support much more accessible than perhaps, you know, the long wait lines that we have for traditional forms of psychotherapy in most communities. And I think there's also a benefit to some people to have an anonymity component to reaching out to someone in that crisis moment. We're also going to talk today about the importance of connectedness through technology and also how it can be the step towards help-seeking and help-giving, that sometimes engaging with the thing that's on your phone or your computer is just a little bit easier as a first step towards trying to solve your own problems or reach out to some kind of resource. So that's where we're headed today. And I'm so pleased that John said yes when I asked him to be on this podcast. John has actually been a very, very important person in my journey into becoming part of this field of suicidology. I always love to share the story that my very first professional experience in the world of suicidology was the American Association of Suicidology's conference in 2007 in New Orleans. I went down there still really in the throes of my grief of losing my brother. I didn't really know anybody. I stepped off the plane at this huge national conference and very quickly met John and all of his colleagues from the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and they just kind of adopted me for that conference and, you know, befriended me and made me feel comfortable, and it was just such a great way to start my journey. Since then, Well, John Spoon, the director of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which you hear me talk about all the time, it is our nation's crisis support line. He's been the director since 2004. And I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I've lost track, he asked me to be one of the co-chairs with Dr. DeQuincy Lezine, who you've heard on this podcast before, as part of the Consumer Survivor Committee. And once I got inside the workings of the Lifeline through that committee, I have been so incredibly impressed and inspired by John's leadership and by what the Lifeline is doing, not just for crisis support, but really shaping the whole field of suicide prevention. Number one, he has been a leader in the area of lifting up the voices of lived experience and the expertise of people who've been there to help shape how we're thinking about suicide prevention, intervention, and even bereavement support. Two, he's a bridge builder. So he is, you know, always seeing how collaboration can happen in new spaces and new places and really working through the barriers and challenges around partnership, which I really value. And then three, as you'll hear today, I was telling him as we were before we were opening the line that we could take this conversation in any number of ways. There's so much we can talk about today. But number three is where we're focusing our time. John's not afraid of technology. He's not afraid of innovation, and that's refreshing. A lot of he's a psychologist by training, and a lot of folks in the field of professional mental health services are leery about the impact of technology, and John has always been the one to say, you know what, let's go figure it out, because it's a train that's left the station, so let's embrace it and figure out how to work well with it. In addition to leading the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, he's the executive vice president of a number of national networks at Vibrant Emotional Health in New York City. He oversees three additional national lines in addition to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, the National Disaster Distress Helpline, the National Football League Lifeline, which is really exciting. And he's also working together with the Department of Veterans Affairs to oversee the Veterans Crisis Line. He also has helped with the crisis text line launch, and somehow he manages to support a private practice in New York City since 2000. And one of my all-time favorite memories of working with John is the moment that we were on the Grammy stage together behind Logic as he performed the 1-800-273-8255 Lifeline song. And it was just a moment where symbolically together we stood up for people who'd been affected by suicide, and I was really proud to share that moment with him. So, John, welcome to the show.
I am so pleased to be with you, my friend Sally, always.
Yay. Yes, yes, likewise. So please take us back and share a little bit about kind of your journey into this work and specifically how you came to be one of the envelope pushers around embracing technology in this space.
I love that, envelope pushers. I'm actually just like to tear the envelope open personally. But, you know, ever since I was a little kid, or a kid, I should say, I wanted to be a psychologist. Now, that you probably think, boy, what a scary childhood he must have had. But that was actually after I wanted to be a pirate and a superhero and a detective and a pro athlete. So like in high school, I began thinking, I really like this idea of being a psychologist. And you know, my pathway to being a psychologist in some respects was pretty traditional. Yes, I got my psychology degree and my doctorate, and I have my private practice. That's really all I wanted back in high school. But it's actually my full-time gig, Sally, that really took a very different path. I had no idea I was going to land anywhere near where I am today. I started off working as a mental health aide in a hospital, and you know, where I would do suicide watch for patients who were in seclusion and restraint. And now, decades later, I'm helping to promote suicide care through a national network of crisis hotlines in communities across the country. So it's been an interesting path, but I'll tell you that one of the more interesting steps along that path, and I think the light bulb moment for me, was not, you know, going from the hospital to an outpatient clinic, which I did, but it was that third job that I first got, and it was here in New York City, actually in Brooklyn. when I began working on a mobile crisis team. Now, for those of you who don't know what a mobile crisis team is, it's actually back then it was extremely rare, but there were not a lot of mobile crisis teams in any metropolitan area in any city. I learned that what this strange creature was the service that would actually go to people who had serious psychiatric problems, who were unwilling and unable to get care on their own. So care had to come to them. So it was basically house calls. And house calls in some of the, Brooklyn is one of the most ethnically diverse, rich areas in the United States, which is fascinating, going into people's lives, into their homes. So it wasn't like they were coming into my office. I was going into their office, their homes, their lives. And when you walk into people's lives, you learn immediately so much about them. And it starts with them being comfortable. Instead of them coming into my office where I'm comfortable, here I'm coming into their home where they feel safe. And I also have privy to me how they're doing, how they're living, how they're taking care of themselves. All of that is evident in their home, and the people who care about them or perhaps don't are also with them typically in the home. And also I can interview them and get to know them, and the assessments that I could make and the ability to engage them and help them feel comfortable with me was a way, it happened in a way that probably couldn't occur, after weeks or months in therapy. I learned so much about people so quickly, and I thought, this is the way care should be. Why it should be connecting with people as closely to their lives as possible. And then I learned, and of course, I learned that, gosh, a lot of these people weren't going to be able to make it to care anyway. That's why we were coming to see them. In fact, the system is filled with situations like this. More than half of the people with mental health problems here in the United States, to two-thirds, depending on the data you look at, Sally, are never going to see a mental health practitioner. And if that's the case, mm-hmm. the system is not designed for the customer. It's designed for the provider. Right. I'll see you on Tuesday at 9. It's not necessarily mm-hmm. helpful for a person who can't even get out of bed because they're so depressed, or a person whose psychosis is going to prevent them from organizing a plan to get to therapy because the CIA is controlling their thoughts. It just seemed absurd. A friend of mine said it's like expecting a person to get to a clinic who has a serious mental health problem is like putting a spinal cord injury clinic at the top of the stairs.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And when did the crises tend to happen? Usually not, the 8 to 5 working hours. It's after hours. It's the middle of the night. It's weekends. You're going to have to wait till we open, 9 o'clock on Monday. That's just not acceptable.
Let's schedule your crisis next time if we can.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a revelation for me that our system needs to be one in which it delivers care when, where, and how a person needs it. And crisis services are set up for that. Our behavioral health care system, not so much, because we recognize that people need help now, but that's really kind of true for mental health care in general, that even ongoing care for many people until they're up and around and about and much better off, are they able to consistently get care? And that's true for mostly very serious cases. So that was a very, very important moment for me. But I used to ask myself, how are people going to know about this amazing service, this mobile crisis service? And how are we going to scale the kind of caring and intimacy and connection that you could get on these mobile crisis teams? So my next job was an offering to start New York City's first crisis information and referral hotline. So that was the opportunity to scale caring, to get into people's homes and give them care when, where, and how they want it. And so that was the next step to being able to serve tens of thousands of people. Now, of course, the Lifeline reaches, last year we answered over 2 million calls a year. And I think about you know, in my private practice, for every one person I see, and I love my private practice, but for every one person I see, I'm also aware that the Lifeline is answering 100,000 calls.
Wow. That's an impressive ratio. That is exactly the thought. Like, if it's only private practice people seeing families and couples and individuals one by one, we're never going to make a dent in it. It's super important work, but there's so many more people that need help.
Right, and it's just this old world technology, Sally, these phones. I mean, obviously there's other technologies we'll talk about, but actually the story of the first hotline, have you ever heard about that story?
No, I would love to. And so what year are we talking about at this point when you're setting up this first hotline?
Okay, so this is like the early 50s. There's this vicar in Britain named Chad Vera, and Vicar Vera reads this story in the paper about this 13-year-old girl whose first period of menstruation she confuses for a bout of syphilis. And in a fit of terror and shame, she kills herself. And he reads this story and is outraged, horrified, and says, this could have been prevented. There's something we can do. We've got to do something. And he said to his community, if you need help, come see me. I'm opening the doors to my office. It's anonymous. It's confidential. You don't need to tell me your name. Just come see me. And sure enough, they came. And there was lines outside his office. And people waited. And by the time they got into his office, most of them didn't need his help anymore. And they said, I feel better. And he said, well, why is that? And they said, well, because while we were waiting, or while I was waiting, one of your volunteers would come over to me and talk with me and listen to me and provide me with tea and help me feel comfortable. And I told them my story, and they understood, and I feel understood, and I feel so much better. Thank you. And he realized, Sally, a couple of things. That one, there's a lot of people that need help and a lot more than he could help. Two, that you don't have to be the most highly credentialed person. You don't have to have a PhD or an MD to be able to provide caring and connection to people. And thirdly, he realized, because so many people need this, and you don't need to be the most highly credentialed person. You just need to be trained to be empathic and connect and collaborate with people. He said, I'm going to start this hotline, which became the Samaritan's Hotline in 1953.
Oh, no way. I didn't know that.
And so that's basically the foundation for scaling caring, which technology is really, really designed to do.
Wow. I didn't know that part of the story. I knew the part of the story of what today is Dee Dee Hirsch and post Marilyn Monroe. But that happened, the UK piece happened before that.
Yeah. And again, it started with just this sense of we need to provide caring and connection to people. It was a desire to reach out. Actually, the Dee Dee Hirsch line started because they weren't even intending on starting a hotline. They were starting a suicide prevention center that was going to study suicide. And when people heard about that, they just started calling and expecting that somebody could help them for their suicidal crisis. And they said, oh, we better start a line.
But the
Samaritan's line was really a vicar saying, we've got to reach people in our community who are suffering. And this is the best way to do it, is by using phones. And, of course, there's other mechanisms that we use now.
And so when you were setting up the first hotline in New York City, what were some of the things you were thinking about related to that?
Oh, that's a fascinating story, Sally. When we first started the line, the vision was, okay, we want a bunch of mental health professionals that's going to answer the phone. And you're going to assess the nature and severity of the problem. And then your job is essentially to link them to the networks of care, the services throughout the city. So it's basically designed to be an assessment and referral service.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, you know, it was great. I mean, we set up, I developed relationships with providers all over the city, and that was great, and developed relationships with all of the city agencies, and we did public communications on the subways, and so we were reaching out. But again, it was just designed to assess and refer mostly. And we didn't know that as we were helping tens of thousands of people starting in 1996, over the next 5 years, what we were actually doing was preparing our city for the biggest response to, I mean, actually what our commissioner called it, the greatest mental health catastrophe in the nation's history. Mm-hmm. We were, on the day in which 9/11 happened, our service, which was, again, the Mental Health Crisis Information Referral Service for the city, it was the quietest day we ever had. We had one call. But we had a house call from the Crisis Intervention Unit Services Director for the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, who came rushing in with the medical director with ash and soot all over them because they had been running the emergency response service for the city, which was inconveniently located in Tower 7, which fell shortly after the World Trade Center did. And they came rushing into my office and said, "Cowboy, we're going to run the whole thing through here." Now, I knew what the cowboy meant. I was from Texas. He knew I was from Texas. But we're going to run the whole thing through here. I didn't know what that meant. But over the next, you know, weeks, months, and years, we were actually in the center of marshaling and connecting and coordinating the resources and outreach response to the largest disaster mental health program and response in the nation's history. It was incredible. But what we learned, and what I think the system learned, is that this ad hoc service that was just being set up for you know, to help individuals and families connect to care, was actually a means of connecting with not only those people, but also providing support for an entire community. And so this crisis infrastructure wasn't just there for individuals and families, but for an entire community that had been affected. And then we learned a few years later, after an evaluation was done of our service, that when people were calling us, and this evaluation was done by SAMHSA in preparation for starting the first hotline network, they sent some folks out to our line from, you know Dr. Maddie Gould and John Califat, who came out to study us because they had heard about the work we'd been doing post 9/11. They studied us and about seven other hotlines to see what worked. And they found that we were a lot more than just an assessment and referral service, that actually what was happening was people's emotional distress and suicidality was being reduced on those calls. So even if you don't get linked to those services that we're referring you to, you're more often than not going to feel better. That it was actually a mental health service that was happening in people's lives for free 24/7 that they could access. And again, this was further buttressing the notion that by using platforms of technology to reach people, you don't have to be face-to-face to make a difference in people's lives.
Yes, and I also think we're also grateful that Maddie and some of the top researchers around suicide and suicide prevention are also neighbors in New York City, and so that you had this tremendous amount of research support in these early years, but also continuing throughout the evolution of the Lifeline and other things that we're providing. Can you talk a little bit more about what that research has shared with you on a little bit more about what's making it work and the standards that have evolved from that to keep that service at the highest level possible?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this is another reason to think about technologies too. I mean, I remember when we first found that, you know, I mean, we found some good news that we were helping people. We also found some news that said, uh-oh, we need to do a better job of assessing people. We're not terribly consistent in the way that we help people who are in extreme suicidal crisis or what we call imminent risk. There's a lot of things that we need to do better. And also there's some people that, guess what, aren't perfect after one call to a hotline, that you probably need to follow up with a number of people who are at higher risk just to make sure they're okay. so there was a lot of things that we learned. But, you know, what was interesting is, I remember John Califat saying, you know, John, yeah, sure, if you could, don't feel too bad about, you know, the needs to improve assessment. If we could train a camera or a monitor on psychologist's office around the country, or had a one-way mirror into every one of those sessions, we'd see all sorts of things that shouldn't be happening. That's actually the beauty of again using technologies to help people, is that you can more readily monitor and look at the ways in which people are delivering care. You can look at data, you can look at transcripts, you can listen into calls. So if you're thinking about quality, these kind of massive means or kind of population-based means of providing care through technologies can really, we can use that data to improve care. And that's what John and Maddie and Brian Mashara helped us do with their studies. They helped us learn that we need to establish standards for risk assessment, which we established and implemented across the country with our centers. They helped us learn that we needed to establish a policy for helping people at imminent risk of suicide, so we could better engage and collaborate with people and de-escalate their crises. We also learned that we should be doing follow-up care. And subsequently, once we learned all of these and put these practices in place across our centers, we then, John and Maddie, and mostly Maddie, studied them afterwards to see, well, did what the Lifeline put in place work? And she's found that, yes, the follow-up has worked. Our imminent risk policy has helped. The follow-up is interesting, and again, I think important that, again, it not only helps people link to care when you follow up with people, but Maddie found that when people were at high risk and we followed up by making calls with them and checking on them, that was actually saving lives. Half of the people said that actually these calls are the reason I'm alive. And when asked why, what was the difference with these calls? The people who consented to these contacts said, well, it really means something to me that somebody was thinking about me, that valued me enough to call me and check on me. It reminds us again of two things, Sally, that it's really basically this basic desire to be cared about, have some kind of meaningful connection with somebody, feel valued in some way, that people need to stay alive in some respects. And then secondly, that technology can help you with that. That phone calls, even if you can't be there in person with somebody, that connection can be established through a phone call or perhaps through chat and text and other means.
And this is just the beginning. I mean, you've been really crafting and iterating and evolving the Lifeline, the call system, to this massive endeavor that is helping millions of people each year. And you also have your fingers in some other technologies and some new ways of doing that. Can you talk about kind of where all of this is headed? What's on the horizon, and how science is informing us on how we might do this?
Absolutely. You know, we've been running a chat service for a while, and you know that I helped launch the crisis text line, where a lot of our centers provide texting services too. So those are all means, and those still need to be studied. But obviously, there's quite a number of other technologies that are out there that people are interested in, and I guess the questions are, one, what are they interested in, what will they use, and two, what works? And there was a study in Australia that came out in 2016, where they looked at about 450 self-harming youth from Australia, and they looked at their online habits to see what it was when they were feeling suicidal. What were they looking for online? And first of all, it's important to note that when young people were seeking help online and they were suicidal, they were also less likely to disclose about their suicidality offline. So these are really suicidal high-risk kids because they don't want to talk about it to anybody. The only place to engage them then is online. And so what are they looking for when they're surfing the internet? And what it showed is they're looking for guidance and support and advice, and they want to feel less isolated, and they want some understanding from their peers, and they are looking for information about how to help themselves. But the things they were most interested in, types of services, was they wanted online chat. They wanted some kind of perhaps apps to help them with their coping when they're thinking about injuring themselves. About half of them wanted peer support. Over 40% wanted self-help. We need to be able to provide for them what they want. And I think, as you've learned, Sally, as part of our Consumer Survivor Committee, you've been advising us on something we're extremely excited about, you and all of our committee members. We're wanting to, this fall, we should be launching what we call our safe space. So aside from just providing crisis chat when people come to our website, and by the way, we get about 5 million unique visitors to our website every year. So this is no small feat or experiment to be providing a litany of online services for people in crisis. We're reaching many, many people who won't phone us, but who could instead, if not use crisis chat, might use some of the self-help resources and apps that we're going to be installing on our safe space, again, which should be launching in fall. And these are our resources. There are apps like the My3 app, the Virtual Hope Box app. There's some self-help tools. I mean, those apps are really designed to be kind of help people design their plans for safety and how to cope when they're feeling in crisis and who to call and what exercises and behaviors to engage in that are alternatives to harming themselves. And we're also working with COCO, as you know, to establish or integrate their peer support app into our program. So we're really excited about all these. These are evidence-based tools. But as you know, Sally, what the real experiment is here is we don't know what people will use. We can have something that's evidence-based, but do people like it? And is it, and how do they use it? And when do they use it? So it's really an opportunity for us to begin studying the use of the population-based opportunity to provide technologies to people and see what they like. And if so, if they like it, why? And how do they use it? So, again, I think this is going to be a major advance for the field.
Absolutely. And so all of the apps and resources that John just mentioned, we'll be putting those on the show notes so you can go in and check them out. As he said, they're evidence-based. So these are apps that have been vetted pretty well, and we have, you know, very good confidence that they could be useful for people who are suffering, but also for the people around the people who are suffering, to give them additional tools to help their loved ones. So you're right. It's not just that we are giving ways, easier access to these apps and helping people sort through, you know, the huge haystack of all these things that are out there to, like, you know what, start here. Start with these. These have a really good chance of being helpful. But we're also now, because it's online and because we can track users, you know, pathways through these things, it's an experiment that's going to teach us a lot more about how we can do better. That's super exciting. So Safe Space is coming out when? Sometime this fall?
Well, yeah, and I really appreciate your asking when, because my guess is by the time this is broadcast, it still won't be out. It will probably be, you know, there's all sorts of approvals that have to occur with SAMHSA, and you know, naturally there's, you know, things that have to be vetted. So I would say somewhere between, you know, October and November. But then then we're off to the races. It will be I think, kind of a new phase of providing offerings to people. Again, the idea is, you know, ever since my experience with Mobile Crisis, is how do we give people what they want when they're in crisis? How do we reach them in their lives? You know, when, where, and how that service is wanted to be delivered by the individual. How do we shape it? How do we give them choices? And I think that's the big issue, is that for years, our system has said, here's what we think you need.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, and when they don't listen to us, we say they're non-compliant, like bad children.
Right.
And I mean, it's really the better question is, you know, how can I help you, and what do you need? Here's some choices that I think can be helpful for you. You tell me what you want and tell me if they're helpful. And this is another opportunity for us to ask that question in a very big way.
And that's so much more respectful, right, and dignified than, you know, we know what's best for you. Oh, and what did we do? Restraints and isolation. Is that
right.
Working? Not so much. So speaking of the future direction, there was a really important piece of legislation that was just passed that might lead to some pretty significant new ways of doing this. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Thank you for asking about that, Sally. Some people may have heard about this legislation that was developed by Utah Congressman Chris Stewart and Orrin Hatch from the Senate. It was introduced in May of 2017. It's called the National Suicide Hotline Improvement Act. And the idea is to propose a study to determine whether or not we should have a three-digit number for mental health crises and suicidal crises here in the United States. So something like a 911 for mental health and suicidal crisis. So the impetus for this was that people, while we certainly are seeing a huge increase in lifeline calls, it's harder to remember 1-800-273-TALK than it is a three-digit number. And 911 has become ubiquitous in our culture, and it's hard to even remember what life was like before 911. It's quite possible that if we have a three-digit number for mental health and suicidal crises, that one day that will be ubiquitous in our culture. But here's what the act is looking at, and it's been passed. No, it's not been signed into law yet. It's been passed by the Senate and the House. There's a few little markups that the Senate has to look at. I think these are formalities, and it should probably go to the President's desk sometime in August. He has about 30 days to sign it once it's signed. And in law, there's a year in which a study must occur. Now, this study has to be undertaken by SAMHSA and by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And they will engage us and a litany of other stakeholders who would be impacted by this and ask a number of questions like, what is the efficacy of the current Lifeline and Veterans Crisis Line systems, and how can we better improve them if we were to attach them to a three-digit number? What's the cost and infrastructure impacts of supercharging access to mental health care and suicidal crisis in this country? What will that cost? What will that mean for our communities? So obviously stakeholders must be surveyed. And this information, and then they will also look at what, you know, they'll do that cost-benefit analysis, and the FCC then receives the information from SAMHSA and the VA in about 6 months. And then the FCC spends the next 6 months looking at three-digit codes, looking at the impact on cell carriers, some of the communications aspects and impacts of such a law or a designation. And then they provide a report after a year to Congress. Now, Congress can choose to act or not act, but the most important thing is that this conversation about mental health and suicidal crises and the importance of it the cost of it and the cost-benefit analysis of it is about to occur at a congressional level and a national level in a way that it never has. That alone is absolutely huge. And the idea of a national mental health emergency response system could become a reality, not immediately, but one day it could.
Yeah, I think, you know, just as I said, it's reached a platform, it's reached a level that a lot of, you know, key influencers, key funders are paying some significant attention to what this all means. And I'm pleased that there's this, you know, let's take a caution approach to really think through what the impact of this major change might look like. And there's certainly a lot of reasonable concerns, but the fact that this conversation is happening so thoughtfully at the highest levels is very inspiring for those of us in the trenches who've been like, somebody please pay attention. And if you would just share, you know, I love you, when you talk about your conversation with your daughter and her perspective on what this
is.
Are you able to share her insight? Because I think it's
sure.
Yeah.
You know, so we've talked about, you know, I mentioned that we're going to have to survey major stakeholders. So, you know, I, of course, have to start with my daughter, who's a major stakeholder for a few reasons. One, she has her own history of anxiety and depression and is very outspoken about that and really cares about what's being done related to that, not just in her care, but in the world. But also why she's important to be surveyed is she's 18, and that means she knows everything.
That's right.
You know, so if you know, the 18-year-olds are the oracle, and it's all downhill from there. But she, when I asked her what she thought about this idea of a three-digit number, she said, "Well, Dad, I think it's going to do more for reducing stigma around mental illness and mental health problems in the United States more than anything else could possibly reduce stigma." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? I'm not sure I'm getting what you're saying." And she said, "Well, Dad, there's already a three-digit number for medical crises. If we had a three-digit number for mental health crises, people would appreciate mental health crises is real. Psychological problems are not just in your head, they're real crises. And they affect you and the people around you. And they require a different response than calling 911. That a person has to be caring and know what to do and do different things than calling 911. And I just kind of rocked back in my chair and I said, I've got to write that down.
Yes, exactly. I do think it has the potential for that. And so if we can take this year to figure out, all right, how do we do that on this very wide scale and make sure that our crisis centers are supported, ready, and able to respond in that different way to the best of our ability, it's going to be a game changer. So, again, thanks for leading that or helping to lead that effort, and we'll just see where it goes. But everybody pay attention because, you know, in a couple of years, it could be a much different and better picture. So thinking about some of the takeaways you want to make sure our audience is prepared for or thinking about, what are some of your what are your strategy takeaways for folks?
Well, I'll come back to the strategy, but I want to think, you know, I think we have a, you know, as we integrate technologies into people's lives in so many ways, and I know that there's been, you know, a lot of cautionary tales these days. I'll tell you another story that has just kind of recently felt prescient to what's happening these days. But, you know, one of my oldest friends, and I think I've told you this, Sally, Tom Gruber. Tom was my one of my, you know, really close buddies in high school that I still stay in touch with. And Tom was always into artificial intelligence. He was one of those guys that got into that really early, and but in the 80s he was the one who told me about this thing called email, electronic mail, and I said, well, what is that? And so he said, well, you know, it's like writing a letter, only you're writing it you know, electronically, and it's delivered immediately. A person can get it from anywhere. There's no postage, and they get it, you know, within seconds, you know. And I just thought, well, that's weird. And it my first thought was, I'm not sure I like that, Tom. I mean, people have a hard enough time connecting in meaningful ways face to face. And I'm afraid that people who are socially awkward or not inclined to talk with people directly are going to become increasingly dependent on online, these electronic means, and will become increasingly disconnected. And he said, John, no, really what it is that people are going to be able to have conversations with people that they would never have met otherwise, and make connections all over the world with and be able to communicate instantly. It will create a much more connected society. And of course, I realized we were both right. And Tom, incidentally, later went on to be the chief technology officer that created Siri and then sold it to Apple. And today is building artificial intelligence tools to help people. His mission, like ours, is to apply technologies to help people who have disabilities or problems in their lives to make their lives better. That's his mission. And so it's kind of nice that you know, he and I over the years, while we still are very much in contact, have kind of landed in the same spot, only in different spheres. But I think the point of the story is that there are things absolutely to be concerned about with technologies, and that we need to be we need to understand the ethics, and obviously what we're learning, and certainly Facebook has learned, is that when you sometimes get out ahead of where people are and not think so much about should you do things, as opposed to, hey, we can do things, and then later said, well, we maybe shouldn't have done it so quickly, that how we do things thoughtfully and engage the research community, engage people with lived experience, engage consumers, essentially, and listen to them in terms of their how they feel and what is working for them is so crucial. And also thinking about how technologies can supplement, not replace, our face-to-face interactions, how they can be used to enrich our face-to-face interactions. That includes getting off them, but also teaching you perhaps things and supplying you with information that can actually help you when you turn off your phone or walk away from your computer, which has to happen. But I think that's a big challenge for us as we've gone in our mental health community for, I'm sorry, no technologies, it's just got to be in the office, to now, you know, we're moving in the technology sphere. And what I think we have to be very cautious about is not thinking so much what can we do, but what can we do in a way that's right for people.
So a great example of exactly what you're talking about is how you and others advised Facebook to shift from this report notion, if I see some suicide content on my friend's page, I'm going to report them, to a support function where now we are coaching the people around the people who are posting suicide content to use interpersonal skills to help support them. And can you talk a little bit about that transition and how user feedback was helpful in shifting how they approached it?
No, I really appreciate your noting that, Sally. That was a bit of a sea change that we were determined to address. And starting with the fact that Facebook is a leader in the social network field, not just because they have a great social network, but they're a leader specifically in suicide prevention. They have always engaged us actively, proactively, as well as Dan Reidenberg and SAVE and others, but I think most prominently Dan and our service, to advise. And they've also worked with Forefront and I think a few other services, and certainly listened to the voices of lived experience. But when in the we started working with them in like 2007, and really the first interactions with them were okay. And look, this is what a lot of social networks care about. When somebody posts that they want to kill themselves, what do we do? How do we report them and get them help? How do we get them to a safe place? And basically, can we refer them to the Lifeline? And so for years, that's what was happening. So when a friend would post that they were suicidal on Facebook, and another friend saw that, they could then report to Facebook, "I'm worried about Bill." And then Facebook would respond to Bill, say, "Bill, friend is concerned about you. Here's the Lifeline number. Check it out." Essentially something like that. And that was the approach. And that seemed, kind of the minimum thing that every social network should be doing. And so they set the standard for that, and others came to us afterwards and did the same thing. And in 2014, I became more involved and wanted to do something different. As you have often preached and know from what the evidence says, Sally, that one of the greatest buffers and mediators and mitigators of suicidality is social connectedness. And I thought, man, that's what Facebook is all about. It's about connecting with people. And when people post online, "I'm thinking about suicide," to their friends, they're not saying, "Friends, report me." They're saying, "Friends, support me." And so this was an opportunity for us to engage Facebook and say, well, how do you teach the friends who are worried about, who then report, they report Bill, and Facebook could then say, "Bob, who's concerned about Bill, here's some things you can do to help Bill, and Bill to help himself." And so the creating an opportunity to educate people about how to help others and support others was really what we were interested in. And when we offered this to Facebook, I mean, they were on fire about it. They said, yes. I mean, there was no hesitation. They were off the races. They said, let's do something. And then worked with us, and then Dan and Forefront and a few others, to create more resources, so when people report somebody now on Facebook whom they're concerned about, they receive messages on how to help that person, and the person who is reported receives not just the Lifeline number, but also tools to help themselves. This is kind of an online version, or I should say a social network version of what we're trying to create with our online safe space, where we would just make it, available to everyone. Here's ways to help yourselves and others. This is really, from my standpoint, one of the most important things that we can do from a public health perspective, that rather than just saying, when you're in crisis or when someone is in crisis, go see a professional or call a hotline. That's all great, but in addition to that, we're going to empower you to help yourself and to help other people, because we can't be everywhere at every time when people need us. That's we want to use the presence, ubiquity, and engagement of technologies and the online space to teach people how to help themselves and others.
And I think, again, what's incubating inside here with your leadership in these conversations and is reflective of what we're seeing in the larger perspective, that we need to get away from a reactive, fear-based response when we see this and really go more towards a community support and a self-empowerment model of how we help people through these darkest times. So I'm just going to take a moment to kind of recap some of the themes that we talked about today and how some of these things fit together, and then I'm going to come back to you, John, for some final thoughts. So we started off the conversation talking about, the way that business as usual happens, with suicide in the early days of your training and experience is still, unfortunately, very common today. This isolation and restraint and quote-unquote treatment that feels more like trauma. And in those early years, you had an awakening, we can do better than this. We can do better, and what we are going to need to do is meet people where they're at, in the safety and comfort of their homes in a way that works for them, not just for the providers. And I love the evolution story of the Lifeline from, you know, the 1950s and the vicar who just happened to notice that the people were being helped in the line waiting to see him, and that there was something there. There was something that we could do. And today, 2 million calls per year coming into the Lifeline, and the efficiency of that, you know, your ratio of, you know, for every person I see in private practice, there's 100,000 people that are being helped by crisis support through the Lifeline. That's just a really important metric to pay attention to, that we can scale this out to a place where we can help a lot more people if we start to think about the efficiencies of technology. The other thing that you're doing very consistently that matters a great deal in this work is continually evaluating the what's working, what's not working with some of the top researchers that we have in the nation. And so I'll drop a couple of those studies into the show notes as well. So we can see, you know, what are the pieces that are helping people? And, you know, one of our insights in just the last few years was this importance of follow-up. It's not enough just to have that call. The follow-up piece is actually instrumental in having people feel like they matter and that they're valued, that someone cared enough to call back and see how they were doing. We are just at the beginning, and this is going to continue to evolve at an exponential rate as more and more technologies are coming to the forefront, and we're trying to figure out how they best fit with this, you know, Lincoln's chain of survival. I'm excited to see how the safe space piece comes forward later this year. It's been really exciting and fun to be on the inside of that conversation and try to figure out how do we vet these different resources and then how do we present them to the user and then how do we evaluate how that's all working. So I love to see that science is trying its best to keep up with all of this innovation and technology. It's a very challenging thing because research tends to move slow and technology tends to move fast, but we've got to figure it out together. And the thing that I like about where we're headed with this is, as you mentioned, it gives people more choices to figure out, this is what I need right now. This is what fits best for me. And from that self-empowerment model, choices is exactly where it's at. And then, oh my goodness, the legislation piece is absolutely huge in how this thing might shift to even bigger and more powerful than we currently have. And just the fact that we're having this conversation at these national levels and really all kinds of stakeholders are leaning in to say, this is a priority for our country. This is a priority for the millions of people that are suffering. What can we do to help them through this and not just leave it to, you know, small local efforts, but really make it a national priority? And then finally, we talked about the importance of technology for connection. And it really is both and. We can benefit from the connection that's happening online, and we still need the in-person, face-to-face connection piece that is so vital for our well-being. But both can happen, and we can also start to improve, like we have done with Facebook, improve the qualities of those social connections online so that people can reach out there. They're going to get something back that's helpful. So all of this has been really exciting and inspiring, and again, I'm just so glad to you know, follow you through this and learn with you on what's working as we try to shape the future direction. Do you have some thoughts, final thoughts, before we wrap up?
Well, first of all, I think you did just an amazing job summarizing that. You know, it reminds me, for those of you all don't know, again, Sally is co-chair of our Consumer Survivor Committee, so she does this routinely at our committee meetings where at the end she just summarizes everything and everyone at the end of it says, wow, we really did do a lot of good stuff while we were here. I mean, Sally, you're terrific, and you don't just follow, you advise and you lead. And so we're so thankful for everything that you've been able to provide for us in the field at large. You're just a blessing for all of us. But I just to underscore a few things that you said, Sally, about what we've been talking about, and perhaps one way to remember it is the three C's, connection, collaboration, and choice, that the most important thing that we can do to prevent suicide is help people feel understood, and therefore we need to connect with them. In order to help them feel understood and not alone, we need to listen to them. And that's where we need to collaborate with them. It's not just telling them what to do. It's not making them do things. It is helping, listening to them and learning what keeps them safe, what gives them reasons to live, and how can they connect to those reasons to live and those reasons to stay safe. And that collaboration can't happen really so much without them feeling like they have some choice. If the collaboration begins with them feeling like they have a choice to do this or not, they can't work with you as well unless you say, well, how would you like to be helped? How would you like to be supported? What's the best way? And so if we want to connect with them and collaborate with them in the ways that we know that suicide prevention is most effective, we do have to give them choices. And that's why we don't just offer them hotlines. We offer them hotline, chat, text, and whatever electronic means we can provide. But we also need to be there for them as much offline as we are online.
That is excellent. What a great way to summarize some key strategies for people who are concerned about others. John, where can people find you if they want to connect with you around this topic?
You can just go into the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline site, and there's a you can just email into the site. That's probably the easiest way. Because I get too many emails already.
Right.
You have to text me and say, John, did you get my email? So the best way, what will happen is that will go to my assistant, and then she'll say, John, check your email. So that's the best way is just to go to the Lifeline site and just email.
And what's the URL for that?
Suicidepreventionlifeline.org. And you can just go to Google and put in suicide, and our hotline number comes up immediately, and our website.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much again, John, for this conversation. So much good stuff here about kind of where we are at currently and where we're headed, and also some really good takeaways for our listeners. For those of you who enjoyed this conversation, please leave a rating and review and subscribe to the Hope Illuminated podcast on iTunes. You can also find us on Blog Talk Radio and on my website. If you want to know more about what's coming down the pike, please sign up on the newsletter so you can get announcements of future podcasts, Twitter chats, webinars, all that good stuff. So in closing, please open your heart, challenge your thinking, and take action to save lives. Together, we can restore dignity and sustain a passion for living.
This is New York firefighter Rafael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase. This is New York firefighter Rafael Poirier. Introducing Firehouse Subs' new $4.99 choice subs. Choose from a medium smoked turkey, honey ham, or roast beef. And remember, a part of every sub you buy helps provide life-saving equipment for first responders. Medium $4.99 choice subs. Firehouse Subs. Enjoy more subs. Save more lives. Limited time only, plus tax, no substitutions. Participating locations. Firehouse Subs will donate a minimum of $1 million in 2018 to Firehouse Subs Public Safety Foundation by donating 0.13% of every purchase.